with the temporary assignment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings upon the request of the Public Service Commission to serve as the procedural hearing officer for this hearing. This is a hearing on the application of Montana Dakota Utilities for an advanced determination of prudence and certificate of public convenience and necessity to purchase and operate the 107.5-megawatt Thunder Spirit wind project to be located in Adams County, North Dakota. This is North Dakota Public Service Commission consolidated case numbers PU 14-843 and 844. The record will show it is a little past 8:30 a.m. Central Daylight Time, May 14, 2015, at the Commission Hearing Room, 12th floor, State Capitol, Bismarck, North Dakota, which is the time, date, and place set by the notice of filing and notice of hearing issued by the North Dakota Public Service Commission on March 25, 2015. On December 22, 2014, MDU filed its application for an advanced determination of prudence in case number 14843 and for a certificate of public convenience and necessity in case number 14844. The notice of filing and notice of hearing for this hearing specified the following issues to be considered and determined upon this hearing. The issues are, one, is MDU's proposed investment in the Thunder Spirit Wind Project prudent? Two, whether public convenience and necessity will be served by the purchase and operation of the facilities. And three, whether the applicant is fit, willing, and able to provide service. Before we get into any of the specifics, I would just ask if there's any opening comments from the commissioners. Chairman Fedorchak.
Good morning, everyone. I appreciate all the work done in advance on the advanced testimony. It's really clear and a lot of good factual information in there, and I anticipate a relatively short hearing this morning of this case. So thanks, everyone.
Commissioner Christman.
I would just echo that. Good application, pretty clear, and looking forward to getting a few questions answered that were in my mind left unresolved.
Mr. Koontz, please state your appearance for the record and any witnesses you intend to call today and identify anyone you think needs to be identified at council table.
Daniel Koontz, Associate General Counsel, MDU Resources Group. Our witness today will be Mr. Darcy Nigam. At council table with me is Garrett Singer. Mr. Singer, as the commission knows, is the Chief Accounting Officer and Vice President of Regulatory Affairs. Behind me is Jay Scable, our Vice President of Electric Supply, and Carl Liepitz, another attorney in our office, senior attorney in our office. And then I think you probably know everybody seated in the crowd.
Thank you, Mr. Koontz. Staff, who will be talking for commission staff today?
I'm John Chu on behalf of advocacy staff. Along with me, I'll be calling today Director of Economic Regulation, Michael Diller.
Your Honor, Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco as advisory counsel. With me is Jerry Lean.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hsu. Mr. Koontz, anything else for the good of the order before I get started with a few more formalities?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. I don't see anyone, but just in case there's anyone present other than witnesses for MDU or the commission who will or may testify or comment concerning this matter today, we will do that at the conclusion of MDU's presentation. I would encourage anyone to take the opportunity to tell the commissioners anything they think the commission should know about this matter and to offer any information you may have for the commission's decision. Not seeing any hands raised or any obvious, I'm not going to go through with the rest of that, but Mr. Koontz, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think before we begin, Mr. Hsu and I discussed introducing the exhibits and stipulating to those, so I'd like to identify the three exhibits that we'll be offering. Exhibit number one marked in front of you is the applicant's application, and there's two copies of that. There's a trade secret copy that's in a sealed envelope. I suggest we mark that as Exhibit 1A. And Exhibit number 2 is the pre-filed testimony of Darcy Nigam, and there's a trade secret version of that. So I would suggest we mark that as Exhibit 2A. And then Exhibit number 3 is a copy of an IRS notice, Notice 2015-25. That notice came out after we had pre-filed our testimony and application. I think the commission could take official notice of it, but we've marked a copy as an exhibit for ease of reference. So I would ask that that would be marked as exhibit number 3 and that we would move the admission of those exhibits.
Mr. Hsu, any objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
Those exhibits will be received.
Your Honor, commissioners, we're very happy to be here in front of you with these two applications. Mr. Scable and Mr. Nigam and their team have worked awful hard over the last year and a half to get this project to where it's at. It's had a few bumps along the road, but we're very pleased with this particular project and the opportunity it offers for the company and our customers. There's two applications here. The first is the advanced determination of prudence, and as noted in the notice of hearing, the issue here is whether the resource is a prudent investment for the company. The second application is a certificate of public convenience and necessity. And the two issues there is, will public convenience and necessity be served by the purchase and operation of this wind farm? And is the applicant fit, willing, and able to provide operation of the facility? As indicated, we have three exhibits today. One witness, Mr. Darcy Nigam. Mr. Nigam will talk about the need for the project, the process by which MDU identified this project and the need for a prudent generation resource, and how it entered into the relevant agreements that are part of the project, and then finally why MDU believes the acquisition of the project is prudent. There are, as I mentioned, two trade secret documents. There's some trade secret information, so in the event that we get into cross-examination, I don't intend to elicit any direct examination regarding the trade secret information, but if we do get into any direct examination where we get into the details of the trade secret, we'll have to figure out a way to mute the recording, I assume. So with that, Your Honor, we're willing to call our first witness.
Mr. Kuntz, I just ask you to be diligent in letting us know if you think we're getting into a trade secret area so we can go ahead and
we'll
do the muting.
We'll be Mr. Nigam to let us know if he's
okay. Mr. Hsu, anything? An opening statement?
No, Your Honor. I'm going to reserve that to Michael Diller.
Okay. Very good. Mr. Nigam.
Good call, Mr. Nigam.
Mr. Nigam, it's my duty as the hearing officer to inform you the penalty for perjury in this state. Perjury is an intentional or misstatement which would mislead the court or mislead the hearing proceeding in such a way as to, have false information in front of it. And having been advised of perjury, the penalty for perjury in North Dakota is 5 years in prison or a $10,000 fine, or both can be imposed. Having been advised of that penalty, will you please raise your right hand? Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Kuntz.
Mr. Nigam, would you please state your name and business address?
Darcy John Nigam, 400 North 4th Street, Bismarck, North Dakota, 58501.
And you're employed by Montana Dakota Utilities Co.?
Yes, I am.
And what's your position and responsibilities in that employment?
I'm the Director of Electric System Operations and Planning. So, among other things, is the company's integrated resource planning and evaluation of new resources, also responsibility for the company's load forecasting efforts and also transmission planning and operation activities.
And you filed pre-filed testimony in this case. It's been marked as Exhibit Number 2 and 2A?
Yes.
And if I were to ask you those questions that appear in that exhibit today, would your answers be the same?
Yes, they would.
Mr. Examiner, rather than having Mr. Nigam read his questions and answers, I would ask that he provide the commission with a summary of his testimony at this time.
Mr. Hsu, any objection?
Objection, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Okay. Good morning, commissioners and staff. Wanted to cover, at least in my opening or comments that I do have, to talk about the process, also the need, agreements, and the prudency, at least of Montana Dakota Utilities' application for a certificate of public convenience and necessity and advanced determination of prudency application for the 107-megawatt Thunder Spirit Wind Project for the company's purchase and operation of that project. The project is currently being developed by Elite Clean Energy and will be sold to Montana Dakota Utilities prior to commercial operation. This project is a prudent ownership opportunity for the company and is a cost-effective resource for our supply today and also into the future. The company is in need of energy and capacity resources, as we've shown in our integrated resource planning activities and through supply resources that we've been procuring for our customers over the past years. We're currently purchasing between 20 and 30% of our customers' electric supply is coming from the MISO market, so coming from others. We also are short capacity resources due to the growth that we have for this current planning year and also our forecasting needs for capacity resources into the future. Our need for power, I think, is outlined pretty well in our integrated resource planning process that we do have. Over the last 10 years, we've seen an average customer growth over the last 10 years of 3.7%. That's an annual growth rate. Over the last 5 years, that growth rate is 4.7% annual growth rate. In the next 5 years, we are still forecasting in our last long-term load forecast an average annual growth rate of 4.7%. What that equates to, at least over between 2014 and 2020, is almost 1 million megawatt hours of additional energy supply that we'll need to require, and also 100 megawatts of peaking, or at least demand resources that we'll have to acquire to meet our customers' needs. As I indicated, we're currently purchasing between 20 and 30% of our customers' energy needs are coming from the MISO market, so they're being supplied from others. And we also are seeing that number growing to about 40% here in the next couple years. We'll be coming from the market based upon forecasts that we have. In our 2013 IRP process that we had for our integrated resource plan, you know, like most of our plans, we do look at all available resources that were available to the company, including coal, gas, wind, and solar. During the development of our 2013 integrated resource plan, we started to receive a number of unsolicited offers from various wind developers. And so through that process, we did go and issue a request for proposal that was kind of late in the development of our IRP process. We did include in our modeling activities that we had was indicative pricings for a wind project for based upon the unsolicited responses that we had seen. And that was in the neighbor range of this $28 per megawatt hour over the term of what a power purchase agreement would be through the offers. Through that RFP process, we did shortlist three projects that were a part of that. And one of those was the Thunder Spirit Wind Project. In our IRP modeling, we did model potential wind purchases, though we didn't have the definitive RFP responses in. So we basically modeled two blocks of 25 megawatts, which would have been a total of 50 megawatts of wind purchase in our IRP. And that was selected for a least cost resource. Subsequent to the development of that model, we also went, once we received the RFP bids, we went and did some additional analysis, whether it was a 50-megawatt purchase, 100, or 150 megawatts. And our model showed that all three levels of those were prudent to purchase. There was a particular difference in pricing between the 50, 100, and 150-megawatt resources. And from economies of scale, the 100 and 150 were about the same price. The 50 was a little bit more expensive through that process. And through some analysis, we did show through modeling that the 100-megawatt resource was least cost, and it was in the best interest of our customers, and we did enter into an agreement for the Thunder Spirit Wind Project that would have been in October of 2013 that we would have had for a power purchase agreement. The Thunder Spirit Wind Project was selected as a least cost resource in our 2013 IRP model in all sensitivities, including a low growth scenario. And even with the Thunder Spirit Wind Project, we were still seeing the need for about 20% of our customers' energy needs to come from others or from the market. The Thunder Spirit Wind Project is a 107-megawatt wind project located near Hettinger, North Dakota, as this commission is well aware. It's expected to have an annual capacity factor of about 45%. It's an advanced stage, currently under construction as we speak, and is slated or scheduled to be in service by around the end of November of this year. The project itself qualifies for the federal production tax credits and the North Dakota earned income tax credits. We'll explain a little bit more. And also it is expandable to 150 megawatts of size. In addition to our needs that we do have, the company, even for this current planning year, is in need of capacity resources. And so we actually purchased 16.6 megawatts of capacity through the MISO capacity auction this year to satisfy our customers' needs for demand here for the 2015-2016 planning year. With the addition of Thunder Spirit Wind and also the Lewis and Clark reciprocating engine projects we're currently constructing, we're expecting not to be purchasing any capacity from MISO or anyone next year. Some of the reasons that we ended up liking Thunder Spirit as an alternative over other wind opportunities that were presented to us, one was the high capacity factor, the low interconnection costs that it had for a site connecting to our Hettinger 230 Junction substation. It had a very favorable PPA price that was below $30, 25 years with a flat contract that was very favorable. It also had a very low curtailment risk. And curtailment risks were one of the things we were mainly concerned about other projects we looked at. Under a curtailment, if something occurs on a transmission system where the system is overloaded, or if there is concerns as far as what the next outage impacts are, a wind project could be curtailed. The other reason for curtailing ends up being economic reasons. This project had a very low curtailment risk because of its location. There were a few other projects that were located in the area around the Thunder Spirit project, and so the developer was willing to take on all curtailment risks under the original power purchase agreement, except which would be buyer-directed if we would tell them to reduce their output or economic, since this project would be a dispatchable intermittent resource under the MISO tariff. One of the other things we were considering of looking at a resource in 2013 was also seeing at least that WAPA and Basin were potentially joining another RTO. So we were very conscious of locations of other projects, whether they'd be on our system or off our system, and if we would have had to move to Southwest Power Pool as a part of their application, what position would we have been in if we would have a project that was actually connected off our system? Was another consideration that we had. So we liked this project because it connected to our facilities, and it really minimized that risk as far as if there was some sort of an RTO change we would have been placed into. As I mentioned before, the Thunder Spirit Wind project, we signed a power purchase agreement with Thunder Spirit Wind LLC on October 25th of 2013. One of the conditions of that power purchase agreement was the developer had not secured their long-term financing and tax equity financing. And so rather than to give them a long amount of time to do that, they had until February 28th of 2014, to put together their long-term supply plan and present that to us. They were unable to meet that deadline, and we gave them several other extensions, and they had several other opportunities for other partners to come in that visited with that project and were never able to put together the conditions that would basically show that they had a financing plan for that. Even though we had agreed in principle to other terms or amendments to the PPA, which would have been a reduction in term and also an increase of price to be able to help them in being able to secure financing. And so in September of last year, we approached Elite Clean Energy if they would be willing to purchase the Thunder Spirit Wind project, develop it for us, and sell it at commercial operation. So that was in September of last year. So Elite Clean Energy worked with Thunder Spirit Wind. They had to get up to speed on the project, certainly become familiar with it and comfortable with it. And at the same time, we worked with them to put together an asset purchase agreement and also an amendment to the power purchase agreement for the Thunder Spirit Wind project. That all came together on a closing that occurred on November 20th of last year. So in about the neighborhood of about 3 months, there was another developer that came into the project, was able to get comfortable with its status, understood that the project was in very good shape as far as it had all of its agreements that it needed and easements. One of the other things that was a concern as far as the evaluation of this project was, did it qualify for the current federal production tax credits? Those tax credits had expired the end of 2013, and it was one of the pieces in our due diligence as well as the lease is how did the project qualify for the production tax credits and how would it continue to qualify for our ownership. So the production tax credits expired the end of 2013, but there were provisions that were part of the last extension that as long as you started construction, that you basically could continue the development of that project and qualify for the tax credits after that date. But there were certain provisions you had to meet, one being that you had invested 5% of the cost of the project and you either showed continuous efforts or continuous progress to be able to get to what was a very clear indication from the IRS that it had to be completed by the end of 2015. Otherwise, you would have to show continuous efforts that you didn't have a delay in the project and that in order to be able to complete its construction in 2016. So we got comfortable that the project would qualify for the production tax credit still because of the work that Thunder Spirit Wind LLC did. The project was in very good shape. And so we moved forward with the project from a development side, knowing that there was some potential risk that if there was a delay in some of the turbines not being completed by the end of the 2015, there was a risk that they may or may not qualify for the tax credits. At the end of last year, Congress did pass an extension of a number of tax bills. One of those we believed pertained to the federal production tax credits, extending its applicability another year. Exhibit 3 that Mr. Koontz talked about, which was an IRS notice, actually was the clarity that those tax credits were extended an additional year. And so rather than the 2013 deadline to start construction and move that deadline out to the end of 2014, and actually instead of having to show that a project needed to be completed by the end of 2015 this year, a project has till the end of 2016 to be completed to qualify for the federal production tax credits. So any risks associated with does the project fail to qualify are really eliminated from that standpoint because the project has met all of the start of construction and all the safe harbor provisions that existed under the original IRS guidelines. Now there's just an additional year to get it done. And so rather than having a 2015 deadline for this project to be completed for the federal tax credits, it has until the end of 2016. Our project schedule has not changed. It's currently scheduled to be completed the end of 2015. We end up with the turbines that are being supplied were certainly procured by Thunder Spirit Wind LLC, so they're Nordex wind turbines. Those turbines are set to be delivered to site beginning in July of this year. Construction on site has begun the end of April with roads, laydown yards, and foundation work is scheduled to start here the end of May and through June. So the interconnection for the project is scheduled to be completed around October 1st. At the end of November, we're expecting commercial operation to occur for the project. A couple of the other things on the transaction between Montana Dakota Utilities and Elite Clean Energy. As I indicated, we do have an asset purchase agreement that is signed with Elite Clean Energy. One of the items that's contingent upon the effectiveness of that agreement is approval of a certificate of public convenience and necessity and also the advanced determination prudency application before this commission. In the absence of that approval, we still have the power purchase agreement in place. It ends up being the back-end agreement, at least in this transaction. One of the things as far as in the negotiation of that agreement with Elite on the amendment of the power purchase agreement, we did do an analysis for the updated capital cost for MDU's ownership of the project and also for the power purchase agreement. We did an analysis of those two sensitivities alternative versus our 2013 integrated resource planning model and also against the 2015 integrated resource planning model that we're currently developing. Through that and the comparison of the power purchase agreement, the updated price, the asset purchase agreement, our ownership of Thunder Spirit is a least cost alternative compared to the power purchase agreement option and as far as in a no-wind option. The value that we've shown and that it's part of my testimony is the ownership provides $30 million of benefits over the power purchase agreement over the 20-year life of the project. The other one over a no-wind alternative, there's over $100 million of benefits that this project provides over a no-wind project sensitivity. Some of the other things about the Thunder Spirit Wind Project, being a North Dakota project, there is a rebuttable presumption that the project located in North Dakota is prudent. There are expected to be about $500,000 in property taxes that will be paid locally. Also in landowner lease payments, there's expected to be about $500,000 annually paid in lease payments to local landowners. From a job standpoint, short term, during the construction of this project, it's expected that the number of contract employees will peak out somewhere between 200 and 250 employees on site during the construction of this. And long term, they'll end up being probably about six or seven long-term employees The operation and maintenance of the turbines itself is contracted with Nordex for the first 5 years of the agreement. So they'll roughly have five people on site taking care of the turbines. Montana Dakota Utilities will be responsible for the balance of plant operation, and also the landowner and all of the permits operations as well. So we will have at least one or two people on site. They'll be Montana Dakota Utility employees for the operation of this project. This facility is a low-cost energy resource for us in our planning and for our customers' needs. It also does supply capacity requirements as well for our customers to meet their peak demand requirements. It provides strong, predictable hedge against future MISO market purchases, of which we're purchasing 20 to 30% today, and that's increasing, and also provides a hedge against future natural gas prices. One of the things that we looked at and asked was, how is this project potentially impacted by any slowdowns that may occur as far as in the Bakken? Part of that, this project was selected as a least cost alternative through our 2013 modeling, and through our 2015 modeling, we looked at including this in a low growth scenario. So if we would end up having, instead of the 5% per year growth, we're forecasting a 0.5% per year growth rate, this project would still be selected as a least cost alternative in those scenarios. One of the other questions that we ended up having is the company's been looking at, and I think we've indicated with this commission of looking to partner and potentially develop in a larger combined cycle project. One of the questions is, does the acquisition of this project impact that need? And the answer is no. You know, we're in need based upon our growth, both of the energy from the Thunder Spirit project and also from the capacity and future energy requirements that a combined cycle resource would give us. Costs for this project are looking to be recovered through our generation tracker here in North Dakota. And the only other one I would offer is, in addition to this proceeding, one of the other applications that we would see before this commission for our ownership is an application to transfer the siting certificate, and that would be effective prior to the close of the transaction.
We have no further examination. Mr. Nigam, he's available for cross-examination.
Mr. Hsu, any questions for Mr. Nigam?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Now, you stated in your application and in your testimony that there are certain upgrades that need to be made to the network in order to have this project be completed. What type of upgrades are we expecting on that?
So the upgrades that are required at the Hettinger Junction sub, which we own, is this the additional 230 interconnection bay to that. So there's a breaker and a set of switches is all that's required. The other thing, as part of this project development, we went and submitted through MISO a long-term transmission service request for the full output of the project. As a part of that, we have one of our 115 lines that goes from Coyote Station to Beulah that we'll be reconductoring as well. So the interconnection cost at Hettinger estimated to be $1.5 million, and the reconductoring of the 115 line from Coyote to Beulah is an additional $1 million.
You said Wanzan Construction will be the company that will be doing the engineering, procurement, and construction of upgrades, as well as the putting of the turbines, right?
That is correct.
And do you have a lot of experience working with them?
We have. They were actually the EPC contractor as well for our Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills projects.
And Nordex will be providing the maintenance for the first 5 years, and you have an option to extend that another 5 years. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you anticipate that probably you will be extending another 5 years with them?
We haven't made that determination. I think it's probably likely that would occur, but again, we'll make that determination once we get into the project and we'll see how the operation goes.
Are there a lot of other reputable contractors in the area who would be able to provide that service as well?
We actually provide the O&M services for Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills, you know, so it's likely that we could provide that service ourselves in the future if needed. There are other O&M providers for wind projects as well in the area.
Okay. This could be extended up to 150 megawatts, as you were saying. With the expiration of the credits down the road, do you think that might prevent any further addition to this?
I don't know that it will prevent that. I think we're looking to see this project certainly is a least cost resource based upon current economic conditions. There may be scenarios in the future, even without production tax credits, where, you know, an expansion could show that would also be, you know, a least cost and a prudent investment.
would any additional upgrading be made to the network if you do put in, I think it would be 17 additional wind turbines?
There would be no additional upgrades that are required. Our interconnection agreement with MISO is for the full 150 megawatts, so it has been studied, and that's what the interconnection is for.
Okay. And the planned depreciation for this project would be over 20 years, correct?
That is what our initial modeling was 20 years.
Okay. How long do you think this could be extended, the use of this project?
Some of that, I think it'll be known in the industry. I think 20 years is a fairly comfortable, time period is for a project like this. I think whether or not, the long-term impact as far as, larger machines or what the likely life will be, but it's very likely it'll be longer than 20 years. So it's more of a conservative estimate.
Would you say 25 years is probably pretty safe? Estimate.
It's potential.
In regards to your request for proposal, I know you spoke about that a bit. What procedures did you have in place to make sure that it was done in a fair and objective manner to make the correct decision? Was it all internal company procedures, or did you use any outside consulting?
For which analysis?
For the request for proposal.
For the request for proposal was one that we did conduct ourselves. We've conducted those ourselves in the past. One of the things that we did have for this request for proposal, and I think it was part of our last rate case settlement in North Dakota, we did make that RFP available to the commission staff here, and there was also an opportunity that they also had to participate in that to basically see what our bids were and kind of know where our process was at.
You briefly spoke about your energy needs in the future, too. And you said you currently are purchasing 20% of your energy needs off the MISO market, right?
Correct.
And when do you anticipate you'll be up to 40% in the future?
So at least some of our analysis that we've done, has shown that could happen as early as 2016.
Okay. So this project will essentially leave it at 20% energy purchases is what you're forecasting, right?
Correct.
Is 20% an ideal percentage that you're looking to stay at? Why not 10% or 30%? Is this just the amount of market risk that you're willing to subject the ratepayers to?
I think it's just kind of a natural. I think we've talked in the past, we were, more comfortable in our last rate case that we had, around the 10% number. We've certainly grown to 20-30, just as a function of our growth. I think that certainly is a question. That we're concerned about is what's that level of market purchases that we have for other. And I think it's one of the reasons that we're also pursuing, something that looks more like a base load resource into the future, which would be the combined cycle resource.
Okay. Have the ratepayers been generally receiving a benefit from those market energy prices at this point?
They have, and that is flows through the fuel and purchase power that the company has.
So this project that you're bringing forward today, this is part of your optimal resource plan, correct?
Yes, it is.
And does that take into consideration the retirement of the Heskett 1 coal power plant in 2020, or is that part of the analysis or not?
So part of the analysis that we do have, at least, was in our 2013 integrated resource plan. We weren't committing to close down any of our coal plants, but we did model, the closure of a facility that would look like Heskett 1 in sort of the 2020 timeframe. And also the Lewis and Clark resource as well. We've done some subsequent updates to that, with some additions. We've kind of taken the retirement of what would be Lewis and Clark and pushed that out an additional 5 years based upon the MATS project work, the mercury and air toxic standard work that we're doing on the scrubber modifications of Lewis and Clark. But that modeling does look at that potential coal plant retirements in the future.
Okay, so the actual optimal resource plan, did that include the Heskett plant, though?
Yes, it did.
Okay. Just a minute, Your Honor. Nothing further.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, any questions? Mr. Nigam?
I did have a couple of questions. I think they've mostly been answered or asked by others. Commissioner Kalk was concerned about wanted to know as much information as possible. He called me yesterday about the decision to purchase changing into a decision to own, and you've explained that, and I appreciate that. A little follow-up on the question about increasing the capacity at the site to the full amount that's been cited. Did I hear you say that you would be, if you were going to increase that capacity above the 107, you would be running that through your IRP process in the normal fashion to make a decision if you wanted to increase it there?
Yes, we would either look through the normal process. The other one we do is, you know, the IRP, one of the values it creates is a model that's developed at a point in time. And so a number of changes that either come along or additions that come in front of us, we're able to use that model and at least continue to produce that as in this proceeding that we had as far as to show what an impact would be if those decisions or new decisions or look at decisions we had made under those sets of conditions.
Okay. And you do those every 2 years, correct, those IRPs?
Yes, we do. Yes,
and we do. Do we have the case number handy of the IRPs are filed here, correct?
Yes, they are.
Okay. So do we know the case number of those IRP cases so that we can maybe at least mention that in the record?
Do not have it.
I don't want to put the whole IRP in this record, but I would people may want to draw on the information in that IRP in this case, and I would like at least the agreement of the parties that we can do that without
We have
sticking
no
a whole IRP into
have,
this docket.
We have no objection to the commission taking notice of that record
okay.
for purposes of this proceeding, if that would be
I
helpful.
Think on page 3 of my testimony at the bottom, it does reference our IRP filed with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. That would be case PU-13-510.
Okay, I apologize. And then the 2015 one is not filed yet, basically, or it is filed?
It is not filed. We're anticipating to file that here at the end of June.
Okay, but you mentioned that some results from the 2015 one that were consistent with your decision here in your summary, did you not?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Questions from the commissioners. Chairman Fedorchak.
Good morning, Darcy. I have a variety of questions. Most of them are just kind of questions to educate myself more.
Okay.
So sorry to subject you to that, but you're good at teaching, Darcy. first of all, in the application, there's a line where we talk about as part of the MISO transmission service request for firm point-to-point transmission service under the PPA, MDU needs to reconductor 5 miles of the 115 line between Coyote and Beulah Junction. First of all, I need to know what is firm point-to-point transmission service and what does it mean to reconductor?
One of the requirements in the power purchase agreement we had with Thunderspur Wind LLC, when they were taking on all of the curtailment risks except for economic and owner, is they were requesting that we would go off and secure a transmission service request. And the transmission service request basically shows you have deliverability from a particular point, which would be that resource, to MDU's load. And it's used in various ways. One of those, if you end up having a situation where curtailments occur, and this was Thunderspear Wind LLC's original thought, that they would give additional priority to the project. So if you would come along based upon standing of transmission service requests, you may have a higher delivery of that project and likely ability for it to get to your load or where your delivery point is. The other thing that we were interested in that MISO allows, if you have a transmission service request for a generator, you can get more capacity credit than the 20% value that MISO assigns and that they study as a part of the network resource or NR studies that are a part of that. Both Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow have transmission service requests from their generation delivery point to our load, so it's a separate study that MISO does. And what it allows us to do is to get more capacity credit out of those resources than the 20% that they're studied for. What the reconductoring means is that we will take the existing conductor that's on those lines and we'll take it down and replace it with a higher rated conductor.
Okay.
We're expecting to use the same structure, so it would just be a replacement of the conductor that's on that line.
All right. Then you talked about the curtailments and what triggers curtailments, and you said one of them is transmission congestion. You said another item, and I didn't catch what it was. Triggers curtailments typically.
And one of those can be stability. that it can be. So congestion is one of those. You can have either congestion that can occur in the real time that you're overloading something, or the other one, a congestion can occur by looking at what's the next contingency that exists. So instead of getting an overload, you look at congestion that could occur real time, which could either be an actual overload that's occurring, or you could look through contingency studies and say in order to prevent an overload, you could basically cause reductions or curtailments from occurring. Mm-hmm. The other ones that occur...
There isn't a high risk of this because of where this project is located.
Where the project is located and not having another generator in the area. The other one is there's multiple outlets. So what this project has at the interconnection site, there's two 230 lines that go out of this substation, and there also is a 115 line. So if you end up losing one of the 230 transmission lines, you still have the ability to use the other 230 line and also the 115 line that's available.
Okay. All right. Come back to the cost. When you may have covered this, but I just want to clarify your agreement with ACE. Is that for a firm purchase price that's already established?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so you don't have to worry about any cost overruns or whatever. That's on there.
That's on theirs unless there were changes of scope that we would request.
Okay. You've talked about this has a nameplate of 150. I remember early on in the power purchase agreement discussions, you're talking about only wanting 100, and I also remember in the siting hearing the company saying they were prepared to go to 150 but weren't because of the power purchase. And you're still buying 20% from MISO, so why aren't you just doing the 150?
So one of the things we looked at, you know, certainly was the difference. We did some sensitivities around what made the most sense for our customers, 100, a 50, or 150 megawatt project. One of the concerns that we had that really, I think, led us to the 100-megawatt project, it was largely about the same price. The 100 and the 150-megawatt projects were very close to the same price under the PPA. The other one that we were concerned about...
Price, you know, per megawatt hour?
Price per megawatt hour.
Okay.
One of the other ones we were really looking at is the amount of generation the company has currently and looking at really what are the light-loaded conditions. So if we take a look when our customer load is very light and we take a look at what our baseload resources are, if they're at their minimum output, we didn't want to get in a situation where we would have an excess amount of wind that we were basically putting into the market that our customers weren't using, so it would be excess energy. So we did studies at 50, 100, and 150. At 50, we didn't see any excess energy. The 100 had a little bit of excess energy in the first few years, but with our growth, it goes away. The 150 had more of a significant amount of excess energy and exposure that we would end up having, mm-hmm. as far as if we would be purchasing 150. So at least
that's not as optimal for your customers.
Correct, because we take on the additional risk. If you've got 50 more megawatts of generation and it all goes in the market.
Can't you sell it?
You can, but you're subjected to what those market prices are. Mm-hmm. So if you're in light-loaded conditions and our customers aren't using it, they have the risk that maybe the price is very low, or in some cases in the past that we have seen, those prices can actually go negative at times.
Is it because the 20% you're purchasing is probably at a different peak, a different time than when this energy is likely to be available?
Yeah, the 20% is throughout the year. And so, you know, with the expiration of the baseload agreement we had with Basin Electric for Antelope Valley 2 Station, you know, we don't have significant enough baseload resources to meet our customers' requirements all the time, even with our renewable resources. Coal plus the renewables we have periods of time, whether it's off-peak or on-peak, that we can't meet all of our customers' needs. So we're pretty much buying energy to meet their needs around the clock just because of a lack of cost-effective resources.
Is this more of an off-peak resource than an on-peak? Do you expect, or do you have a percentage of, do you allocate it, like, or estimate what percent you might be able to count on this during peak?
Other than our, you know, the experience we've had with our Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow projects, which are in that area, you know, their output tends to match up you know, better, I think, as far as what our peak is than other projects around the country. You know, there is still a, you know, wind that does blow at night and in the off-peak periods, but at least typically, you know, there is an opportunity, I think, for the wind to match more of what our customers', you know, load shape is.
There's an opportunity, or you think it will?
I think it will.
Okay. So you think this project will help you meet your peak demand?
It will meet our peak demand through capacity credits that are assigned through MISO's resource adequacy to this project. And we're expecting about a 20% credit that we'll receive for this project.
All right. On page 7 of your testimony, you talk a little bit about this. It's second paragraph. All the wind energy purchased under the PPA is at the contract price, and if the project generates more energy than the P50 wind forecast, the company still pays the contract price for all the energy above P50, but if you own it, you get all of it at no additional cost, basically. So tell me, what is the P50 wind forecast? Tell me what that is.
So the P50 is just a probability. So when you look at an output level, you're saying there's a 50% probability that the project will achieve this particular output level. The P50 level for the Thunder Spear project, I think, is about 426,000 megawatt hours per year. Mm-hmm. If you would go to a P90 level, so there's a 90% guarantee that you'll achieve that output level, certainly the output is going to come down. And I think the P90 level is still somewhere north of 400,000 megawatt hours. Mm-hmm. So depending upon a power purchase agreement price, if you're forecasting that to be at a P50 level or whatever the developer is, that's what they will set their pricing against. And so if they're using a P50 model, that 50% of the time it'll be above, 50% of the time below, and that's how they're recovering their money. If the wind blows more than that annual amount, you know, we're still paying them the contract price for that energy. Mm-hmm. Or if the customer owns it, you know, in a sense we've placed the project in rate base, they'd get the additional benefit of that. Mm-hmm. So from our modeling, we've forecasted the P50 level for an output for this project.
Okay. Can you, on this tax document that you've provided from, can you tell me again where what this is from? And can you point to the language that you that exists in here that assures us that the project qualifies even if it's not completed until January of 2016.
Sure.
I didn't want to skip listening to you to try to find that myself.
Sure. So this is an IRS guidelines. So the IRS is interpreting or providing guidelines as far as what the legislature ended up approving. As far as in last year's, I think it was around December 19th. I think it was, of 2014, that Congress extended tax credits, including this. What this would allow is a facility to qualify for the tax credits. Again, I got to get the right document in front of me. Which one did I have? I have construction, the PTCs. So the prior one had to have construction that would, prior to the very bottom of this, prior to this TIPA, it required the construction to begin before January 1st of 2014. Now what this is doing is saying that basically a project begins construction prior to January 1st of 2015, which is in the first paragraph. So it extended the applicability of this tax credit for an additional year. And all of the other IR notices provisions would also be extended by that same year.
Okay, so it's the second sentence of the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mr. Nigam, also, Commissioner, I would point out that the top of page 3, I think, is kind of summarizes the IRS's determination there, beginning with the sentence begins with thus.
Yes, thank you. So the taxpayer begins construction prior to January 1st of 2015, and Thunder Spirit had shown they demonstrated that prior to, actually to January 1st of 2014, and places the facilities in service prior to January 1st of 17, and we're expecting this year that'll be done, it would meet the continuous efforts or continuous construction test.
Okay, very good. Let's see here. In your modeling, I'm sorry if I missed you talking about this. Did you model gas peakers, the construction of and use of gas peakers for the same resource need?
We did. And so we looked at simple cycle gas turbines and also combined cycle resources. So in that modeling, we had the selection of the Thunder Spirit Wind project that occurred. I think in my testimony, the output of those that modeling shown on the page, it's on the DJN1 exhibit, so it's the second to the last page. So the modeling and the optimal resource case, in addition to the wind power purchase agreement that it had, it also was showing the addition of the Lewis and Clark mercury and air toxic standard projects and also some reciprocating engines in 2015. One of the things we had in the 2013 optimal resource case that we did have is we were using a 90% coincidence factor for resource adequacy in MISO. One of the things we've talked about with our membership of staying in MISO, not joining SPP, was resource adequacy and that requirement. And 2013 was really the first planning year that we had looked at this coincidence factor. And rather than to use the 80% we were receiving, we were conservative in nature, and so in case it went back up, we were using a 90% number. Mm-hmm. We also had a sensitivity where we did use the actual 80% coincidence factor number, and it didn't change the need for the Thunder Spirit project or the combined cycle resource. The only thing it was changing was the reciprocating engine need. But we do also show in the future after 2015 more reciprocating engines in 2017 and also the combined cycle project in 2020 were a part of our optimal resource plan.
But you didn't choose that, right? I mean, you're not doing that. You're doing number two, if I'm understanding this correctly.
So we.
But what are the 73 megawatts of reciprocating engines in 2015?
So the 73 megawatts of reciprocating engines, our model showed that because we were using a 90% coincidence factor for our MISO.
Do you own those already? Do those exist?
No, we're actually in the process of constructing right now 18 megawatts of reciprocating engine projects.
So where does the rest come from?
So the rest comes from our reduction in our capacity requirements. Instead of using a 90% coincidence factor, we use an 80% in MISO. And so that dropped our requirements down from needing to add this 73 megawatts of resources in 2015 to only needing to add what would end up being about 18 is what we're short. We're short 16 this year.
All right. Okay, so can you walk through that the other models here that you looked at?
Sure. So in the optimal resource case, we end up seeing there is a 50 megawatt wind purchase that was a part of this. That was the original supply side resource we included in the model. That was the one based upon the indicative pricing. So when the model was completed, and with the ownership of Thunder Spirit, that we end up having, and also with the amended power purchase agreement, we went back to our 2013 model. This would have been modeling to construct this exhibit that we did last fall, mm-hmm. based upon this opportunity that we had to develop and own the Thunder Spirit Wind project. We looked at in scenario two, which is the case if we would use the original optimal resource case model, but instead of having the wind power purchase agreement, we would let the model see if it would select the ownership interest in the 107.5 megawatt project, of which it did as being a least cost resource. It comes in 2016 because of just the timing, mm-hmm. that before we were looking at this project might have been sooner with the developer. Now based upon actual construction time for this project, it'd be the end of 15. So it shows coming in 16. That had a particular net present value for the study life of that, which is this $3.4 billion. Mm-hmm. The next one we did is we took that same optimal resource case, and instead of the ownership, we took the power purchase price that we would have had under the amended and restated power purchase agreement. It selected that power purchase agreement as least cost as well, and you can see there's a different net present value that occurs. So there's a $30 million difference of net present value between the ownership scenario and the power purchase agreement scenario. And then in the next case, which is the third, with no wind, we basically had no wind available to the model. So there's no power purchase agreement. There's no ownership interest. And you'll end up seeing there's a different value that it has, which is almost $100 million more.
So that would that model would show what you'd have if you just use peakers, natural gas peakers, for filling the need and not having wind.
So this would be the scenario, and this one here, where we'd be purchasing 40% of our energy requirements in 2016. If we did nothing, it would be under this case. And so we would rely more on the market. You know, we also have gas peakers that we've installed, like the HESCA 3 unit, and we have gas turbines that we own in Glendive and Miles City, Montana. The customers have, you know, pay for those. There's available. If the market prices get high enough, you know, those units will economically dispatch.
I see. Okay. I think I just have a couple more questions here. You mentioned in the modeling on page 15 of your testimony some of the factors you modeled. Let's see. And one of them was D, the applicability for incentive property tax and earned income tax credits for wind generation or current tax laws as proposed by Empower in the next session. Did those pass? Did that change at all based on the session in a negative way?
No, they did not change in a negative way, and they were extended.
Okay. All right. Okay. When you my last question relates to sort of some of the more siting related issues, but it does kind of lead into expansion potential for this project. There were some rocky roads with the relationships with landowners down there in that sort of saddled this project early on. It seemed like those got straightened out. Can you speak at all to any residual negative relationships that might exist with landowners that could impact, you know, expansion, or we could hear about if you decide you want to expand?
Sure. And you know, since the acquisition of this project by Elite Clean Energy and it moving forward now, I think that the landowner relationships have gone very well. You know, certainly I think there was one concern, particularly I think it was with the landowner's name were Elders. You know, they had a piece of property they were trying to sell to the project, and I think they also had, I think, a request before this commission for reconsideration. You know, those concerns have been taken care of. The property that they had, you know, was purchased by the project, which was part of a prior commitment that the original developer had made to the Elders and never completed a transaction, or it was dependent upon their financing as well, the same as our power purchase agreement. So that issue has gone away. Other than that, you know, the landowners and the county have been very supportive of this project. We really haven't seen any issues that have come up. Regarding the expansion, you know, the leases for an expansion are all under place. So there's nothing additional that we have to go out and secure.
Okay, good. Thank you, Darcy. I don't have any more questions, Judge.
Commissioner Chrisman.
Good morning, Darcy. Is the written testimony that you submitted the same as the one that we received earlier in the application? I looked at a few sample pages. It looked the same, but
yes, it was.
Okay, that's helpful. Then I can use my marked up points to ask questions with. One of Mr. Kuntz's first questions was whether you would answer those questions the same in your discussion of the IRS production tax credit ruling. Would that be an exception to that your PTC answers on page 7, 8, and 9 would be different now?
No. When we entered into the transaction, it was one of the things we were concerned about. We also indicated, I think, at the end of my testimony that that Congress had extended a number of tax credits that we assumed that part of this PTC extension was a part of. And so at the end of the discussion on PTCs, and I'll look for that, it indicated to that, and we thought that risk was minimized or was eliminated.
Because this on page 9 at the end of the paragraph that carries over from page 8, it says that MDU concluded that the activities conducted by TSW during 2014 would likely satisfy the continuous efforts test. And now this sounds like pretty much a certainty. I haven't read this IRS document, but you feel more comfortable than just likely now?
yes, we are very comfortable that it would. Well, we were very comfortable that it would qualify for construction and completion through the end of 2015. Any concern would have been if any turbines would have been delayed into 2016 for being completed. And so with the new IRS guidelines and with the extension of the tax credits, there is no concern for that delay of any turbine into 2016.
Okay. You have 138,000 customers and 89,000 are in North Dakota, correct?
Yes.
So I figure that out to be like 64.5% about. But in here somewhere, and I thought I had highlighted it, but maybe I didn't. It says that the North Dakota share of the costs here would be 71%. Why is that?
So not all customers are the same. You know, that's including, you know, all residential, small, you know, C&I, large C&I customers. They're all counted or weighted the same when we talk about customer counts. So when we take a look at what their actual usage is and we end up doing our jurisdictional allocations, it ends up being a higher percentage just because of the different types of customers North Dakota has.
Okay. Then this isn't from your testimony, but or at least from the written part. But can you explain to me again, you did somewhat to Commissioner Fedorchuk, but I still didn't follow how this ties in with upgrading the insulators from Coyote to Beulah?
So part of our transmission service request that we have, which is a study that looks for deliverability in MISO's model, that it looks at our application was for delivery of the output of all of Thunder Spirit to MDU's load. And so MISO will look at a deliverability of that. So there's some other modeling time periods, and I don't know specifically what they are, that they look at those, whether it's more like the seasonal or they turn the generation on at peak, which otherwise on peak it's only on at 20%, to see if you can actually get it to the load if it's deliverable. What it was showing is that there was an overload that was occurring, and again in the model, that ends up occurring on that segment, the 115 line in a study model that ends up going from Coyote to Beulah if you wanted to basically show you had firm transmission under that study case. And so the way to mitigate that is basically to go off and look at what rating would that line have and how do you increase the line rating. You know, one way is to reconductor. You know, the insulator stayed the same. We basically go and we reconductor the line so that it has a higher capacity rating on it.
Is that just something that they found and this addition into the system is a kind of a tool to encourage you to upgrade that? Or is it because does this power somehow flow in and have to go through that same segment of line?
So when we would look at MDU's transmission facilities, you know, certainly one of our paths back, the way our system is connected, you know, is from Hettinger up on the 115 line to Dickinson that goes to Coyote. And from Coyote, it goes on the 115 line up to Beulah. And so that's part of our transmission system. And so part of that, if you talk deliverability and you want to show that you have full delivery of that on peak, you know, it is the need that here at least is an impacted element that has to be mitigated.
Okay. On page 12 of your testimony, you talked about ownership of the RECs. What's the significance of that or in our decision here?
So, part of that, I think, was just being clear that either under a power purchase agreement or that we would have under an ownership, all of the renewable energy credits belong to us. So certainly if we're the owner of the project, the renewable energy credits are ours. Also, we were purchasing those as part of the power purchase agreement. We would be able to receive those renewable attributes as well. So they were included in the PPA price.
Okay. And did I understand you right, to Commissioner Fedorchuk's question, the Senate Bill 2037 didn't change regarding the property tax.
So the property
applied to the wind facilities.
So the property taxes, as what that Senate bill passed, it would be the in lieu of method. And so one of the things that was occurring was incentives that existed for central assessed facilities. I think in the future all wind resources are going to be treated the same. So property tax will be assessed not on a percentage assessed value, but will be on a capacity value that there'll be so much for, and plus also on the energy production. And that's very similar as how we had modeled the property tax in our model that we had.
Okay. When you talk about this being a low-cost resource, and then also at a different point, if I understood you correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, that the original wind developer was unable to get the financing to do the project, even though you had actually increased the price. It tells me they were way underestimating either their costs of building it or what they could make from the project. Is that correct?
Yes. So one of the things when we looked at, if I step back, one of the things we looked at when we looked at this project for Thunder Spirit, we certainly looked at what their price was that they had offered in the original power purchase agreement. It was very similar within the range of other options that we were given, at least around the area. So it was not an outlier by itself. It was consistent and was in the range with other proposals that we had received. You know, one of the ones we certainly took a look at ourselves, because we've built some projects before, is we looked at this and said, based upon that price they originally had offered to us, was that something that we could build ourselves for at that time and to be able to own it in that price range? And we ended up saying no. I mean, it was lower than what our costs would have been. And so there certainly was a concern, you know, that was the price too low? We felt very, I think, supportive of this project just because of some initial sponsorship that they had behind it that led a lot of credibility to it. And so based upon the price being in the range of other proposals we had seen, and at least who their initial backing was when this project came to us through the RFP, we were comfortable, you know, that they would be able to produce on what was in the agreement. But certainly we understood that it was, you know, a very competitive and what appeared to be a very aggressive price.
So one of the things that frustrates me with any of these projects where we have these quick time deadlines to meet some big federal incentive program is that there are very optimistic projections on seemingly every one of them. And one of the things that we heard when we were being asked to site this very facility was what a great low-cost resource it was going to be. However, now that they didn't turn out to be able to produce it with the cost that they were using and telling us that it was going to be. So what assurance do we have that now when we're talking about it again as a low-cost facility, what assurance do we have that it is in fact going to ultimately be so low-cost? It seems like the projections are always whatever it takes to be the lowest cost at the time.
And one of the things I think I would offer is certainly, you know, a couple. One is from the standpoint of being low cost. You know, we originally modeled a project like this. We talked about on our integrated resource plan it being about in the $28 range, and that was flat over the life of the contract. You know, one of the things we have is we modeled it ourselves, and this is based upon the fixed purchase price. The project is under construction. It's very well known. It's defined. We understand what the costs are. For ourselves, we're modeling this at a levelized, you know, 20-year cost of $32. So it's still not significantly more than what the original price was at $28. We're now at a $32 project. we put it back in the same model and say, would a $32 project, a $28 was lease cost, would a $32 project still be lease cost? And the answer is yes. And so one of the questions before us is what still stands in front of us? You know, as we've talked about, we have this fixed purchase price for us to acquire this project, which we've modeled in there. We also do have on the operation and maintenance side, you know, there is a five-year agreement that we do have for the operation. So a number of those costs are fixed as well, what it will take to do that. The other thing we get into is the assessment of the wind and the wind resource itself. You know, there's a number of studies that Thunder Spirit had with a number of developers. They all consistently point back to a very high, very strong capacity factor that isn't really that different or an outlier from other projects that we end up seeing in the area. So there's a lot of information, I think, as this project is developed that indicates that it's very far along, it's advanced, it's developed. The price hasn't changed significantly from where it was. Under the original economics, it would still be lease cost, and if we would look at it today as an opportunity, it still would be lease cost to us.
So even though the first estimates were wrong, they're still low enough that even though they've gone up, they're still lower than something else.
And one of the concerns with a power purchase agreement, this is actually the third wind power purchase agreement we have entered into. You know, the other two projects, you know, both started off as qualified facilities. They never were built. They could never get financing, and so they were ultimately terminated. This particular one, we ended up having a concern with them where their price was. Were they just going to basically, you know, push the price down as low as they could to get, you know, a project from us and then come back and find some other reason to basically raise the price at a later date? And so we did a very good job, I think, of, one, not overcommitting, giving them deadlines to get their financing. So in case they couldn't hold us to or drag us through, you know, making us committed to this PPA, you know, for years and years, they had a short time period to get their financing in place. And certainly we had indicated to them that what they offered to us as a price, you know, they needed to hold. And so I think we did a very good job, I think, as managing one, setting the contract up in the terms, and the other one trying to minimize risk, you know, for, you know, cost increases in the future that they, you know, potentially could have tried to pass along to us.
Do you have any discomfort that the potentially the same people who thought that at the previous price that they could get financed and get this built and make money selling it to you under the PPA, that it's the same people who have calculated the very high capacity factor of this facility?
I don't, because one of the other things we did is when we ended up, one of the reasons we contacted Elite Clean Energy is they've developed other projects in the area. They understand the economics of other projects. You know, from their analysis and what they've done as far as looking at this in a fixed price and of also looking at the wind resources and assumptions, you know, they felt very comfortable with, and so it gave us comfort as well that they didn't find any fatal flaws that they had as far as the model or this opportunity. So I think we have a very strong wind developer, a very strong presence in the area, you know, that's developing this project. They're very comfortable, and they were comfortable still enough to offer us a power purchase agreement as well.
I want to switch to reliability a little bit now, but along my same concerns about overly optimistic projections. If we get down the road a few years and have reliability issues because there's not enough power at the times when we need it and people are complaining, what would be your response to someone's suggestion that we did this and the way we ended up being able to build this project without adding lots more peaking was we just lowered the capacity rating from 90% to 80%. Isn't that kind of a smoke and mirrors way of justifying?
I don't think so. You know, part of that, I think there is a very robust process ensuring that the system is reliable today and in the future. You know, certainly, we do have a number of other resources. We've talked about our gas turbines. We have almost 200 megawatts of gas turbine resources, you know, that Montana Dakota Utilities does own. They are available to the customers either for economic or reliability or emergency purchases. one of the things with those types of resources, because they're peaking, is they are not as economic as what the market is. We see a wind opportunity like this, and what happens is it's very competitive with what the market is today and where we forecast market prices to go in the future. That's really the big reason this project, I think, makes sense as a least cost. It isn't because it's a capacity resource. It's because it's a low-cost energy resource. We have other resources in our fleet that provide that reliability. The other ones, as we go through, we participate in a much broader footprint or market that we have for ensuring that there's sufficient resources for everyone, which is the resource adequacy group that MISO has. There's advantages for us to be in that, as we talked about, which is a benefit to the customers, is we don't have to carry 100% of our peak capacity requirements, plus the planning reserve margin. If we'd go back and look what we actually carry, we're probably still carrying on a nameplate basis more than our customers' requirements, and we can pretty much meet what our forecasted peak customers' requirements are, you know, very close to with just our own capacity resources we have. So I think we have a very robust system, and I don't know that I would say that there's smoke and mirrors of how we're trying to put this project in as far as somehow is degrading reliability. You know, I think there's a number of very robust processes that ensure that service is protected to the customers. And I think it's one of those things as we look at, it's that not depending too much on the markets, but at least one, we take advantage of the markets where it makes sense economically to our customers. But the other ones, we need to ensure that absent, you know, losses, significant, you know, reductions in resources in the markets, that we can provide reliable service. You know, and I think we're doing that.
The state's renewable energy objective is that 10% of electricity sold at retail within the state be obtained from renewable sources by 2015. In your testimony, you said 7% current without this, 7% of MDU's energy requirements come from renewables, and this would bring it up to 20%. But when you were talking there, are you talking about the overall system or of state customers?
That would be our overall system. So if we look today from the renewables we get from Cedar Hills, Diamond Willow, and Glen Ullin, that we end up with 7% of all of our customers' energy requirements comes from those three facilities. So 7% of their energy comes from renewable sources for all supplies. So when we add Thunder Spirit, now we'll be at 20% of all our customers' energy supplies. Their megawatt hours will come from renewable sources.
And since those are North Dakota facilities, actually, for what you sell at retail in North Dakota, those percentages would be, each would be higher, the current as well as what it would be after this.
And part of that, all of our resources, you know, we have an integrated system. So it isn't just North Dakota customers that own that. There ends up being a percentage, and the renewable energy credits are actually allocated based on those same jurisdictional percentages as well.
Okay. And my last question is the significance of the ADP to your process. If you were given CPCN but not an ADP, what would the impact of that be on the company and company's plans for this project?
I think it's something we'd have to look at, but I think we heard, I think very clearly, I think one of the last wind resources that we had in 2010 when we were developing the Cedar Hills wind project, we came in for a certificate of public convenience and necessity. We thought that was adequate, and we were asked, why didn't you have an ADP at the same time? So I think one of the things we've come back in and we've asked to try to do them both at the same time to be able to answer those questions, and at least I think we're being very open, and I think in front of the commission is saying we think this is prudent and we think we should also be granted recovery for this project. So I think we both kind of see them going hand in hand, and if we were given one, denied the other, I think we'd have to go back and look. But ultimately, we still would have a power purchase agreement for this project, and it would cost the customers more, I think we've shown in the long term, you know, based upon the prices under that PPA.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Fedorchak, did you have another question?
Just one more, just to confirm my understanding of your response to one of the questions from Commissioner Christman. And this was relating to the use of your generation fleet to meet your demand and market, you know, how the company balances all that with market purchases, et cetera. So I took your response, dumbed it down, And my summary of what you, my understanding of what you said is that you have the resources, almost all of them, perhaps, maybe all of them, to meet the demand of your customers. You have your own generation resources, but you're using market purchases and projects like this to lower costs.
Yes. And so part of that, we have resources, and again, they're peakers. Those peakers, you know, serve a purpose. They help us meet our capacity requirements we have. They also give us an ability, if market prices get high enough, that those units would basically run, they would dispatch supply energy, and they basically hedge against prices being higher than what their supply costs are. You know, we have opportunities through the markets or purchasing from others that rather relying on those costs to be able to purchase from something that is at a lesser cost. Mm-hmm. One of the things we'll end up seeing is a lot of those purchases that we have, which is below the cost of our gas turbines, those purchases from others have been increasing, you know, since 2005.
So a lot of your market purchases are because you can purchase it cheaper than you could run your own gas turbines.
Yes.
Okay. And then on the protections for, you know, optimistic pricing that you were discussing with Commissioner Christman, my understanding here on this, and I want to just have you confirm it or correct it, is that you have a firm purchase price from ACE, Elite Clean Energy. So, and then you have the contract, the five-year contract for main O&M. So you pretty much know what the costs are going to be. There isn't a lot of risk here. It's a contract. They are committed to buying, selling it at this price, and you know what the O&M is. There's no fuel cost for wind. So there's not a lot of risk for the prices changing here, and the fact that Elite was willing to provide you a power purchase agreement, too, as an option, gave you confidence in the fact that they even think that they can make money at this based on the wind resource, so you don't feel like there's a huge risk that you could purchase this at that fixed cost and then have the wind resource be worse either because of Elite's confidence in that and willingness to provide you the power purchase agreement?
That's correct. I think for all those points you indicated, we have a high level of confidence and also protection. One of the other ones I didn't mention is even there's even protection on the equipment side, which is through Nordex, that they have performance guarantees. So if the availability of the equipment is below 98-97%, they actually have make-whole payments that they end up making to us. So if their equipment doesn't produce, there is a mechanism that we can get recovery that way as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Darcy.
You're welcome.
We'll go around one more time. Mr. Kuntz, any follow-up?
Just one follow-up, Mr. Nygum. I'm not sure how clear it was, maybe in my own mind. I think Commissioner Christman asked, and if I can use Commissioner Fedorchik's dumbed down for me, is why does electricity that's entering the grid at Hettinger require you to reconduct or rewire, put bigger, stronger wires on a piece of the system between Beulah and Coyote?
And so part of that is we're adding additional energy into a system, and the system is tied together. And so part of that, the conductor between Dickinson and where you have Hettinger certainly is large enough that it can carry, you know, that additional output. And what you end up seeing is if you put 100 megawatts on the system, it has to go somewhere. The customers aren't right in that area. So as it flows out, you're going to see additional current or megawatts that end up flowing on lines. And what you may find is that all the facilities near the Hettinger substation are sized adequate. They're large enough, but you may end up finding what ends up being the next weak point or whatever that was maybe a little bit marginal to begin with actually is a couple substations away.
So if you're putting in power at Hettinger and your load, for example, is at Bismarck, and Bismarck Manan's probably your biggest load center, isn't it?
It is.
So if you're going to get that to Bismarck Manan, does it go through Coyote Beulah, that power? Is that one of the routes it could flow through?
It'll take the path of least resistance, but at least electrically it is connected. It would flow up to Dickinson as one path and then either go along, you know, an interconnected line along the interstate, or it has to go up to Beulah to come back to Dickinson. But it would follow whatever the least resistant path is.
And with that additional power possibly going through Coyote Beulah, that's the need to beef up those wires? Is that?
It would be, yes.
No further questions.
Mr. Hsu.
Nothing additional.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Yes. a little back several questions ago and several questioners ago, you were talking about doing those transmission service requests, and by doing that with MISO, you gained capacity credit on the wind farms. Is that correct?
But it, potentially, because MISO will study, if you have a network resource, they will study the resource being on at 20% of its output under the peak conditions. And that's where you receive capacity credits, is on the peak conditions. So if you would demonstrate an output higher than 20% without a transmission service request, you would not be granted those additional capacity credits.
Okay. So Jerry was asking me, and again, I noted it down, but can you identify the increased capacity credit for the three wind farms that you either have or potentially have?
So
the amount of increase?
So currently, I think Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow are both around about 20% they're receiving. I think it was when Cedar Hills first came on, we actually received almost a 30% credit out of the Cedar Hills project based upon actual production that it had on peak.
And the others? Any?
So Diamond Willow, I think at one point was a little over 20%, and we received that credit for that.
Okay.
But I think both of them right now, I think with just the history, I think they're back around about 20% again. It changes every year.
Okay. And do you have an estimate for Thunder Spirit or not?
What we've assumed, at least initially, is just the MISO 20% value.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all I have.
Commissioners, anything further?
Nothing further.
I don't.
Mr. Agam, you may step down. Thank you very much. Mr. Koontz.
We have no further witnesses.
I think we'll take a little break, maybe mm-hmm. 10 minutes. Looks like it's about 10:02, so I guess it's 10 right now. It's 10 after 10. 10:15?
Please.
Okay, 10:15. We'll be back. Okay, back on the record after a short break. It's about 10:15. MDU has rested its presentation. Mr. Hsu.
Your Honor, previously I had passed out an exhibit list along with that. Mr. Diller's direct testimony this marked PSC1. At this time, I'd just like to move this into evidence. I move this into the record. I've spoken with the opposing counsel on this.
Mr. Koontz? Okay. PSC Exhibit 1, is that how it's marked?
Yes,
will be will be received.
I believe we also have a correction that needs to be made to the record as well, Mr. Diller.
Yes. Am I doing that?
Yeah, before we do that, why don't we just swear Mr. Diller in? Mr. Diller, you've heard the admonition many, many times, so I'll just ask you to raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do, and that's why I have a correction to make. Shall I move into that correction then?
You may.
Okay. On page 5... unfortunately, I was reviewing this yesterday to make sure all my facts and figures were correct, and I noticed where I had made a small mistake. It doesn't really change my testimony significantly, but on line 23...
Which page again?
Page 5 of my testimony, line 23. If we could insert after efficient gas... the words combustion and engine. So it'll read efficient gas combustion and engine turbines, and then I'd like to cross out the words in the parentheses. And the reason I'm doing that is I noticed that when I had done my calculations that I had based them on the combustion turbines and the reciprocating engine's heat rates, I thought I had captured the combustion turbine and the combined cycle units. And so on the side there, if you want to just write like I did in my side notes, CC and $5, that will tell you that Thunder Spirit Wind is cheaper than the most efficient combined cycle gas turbine when natural gas prices are $5 or higher. That includes all
no,
my...
No further changes need to be made?
No further changes.
Feel free to proceed with your opening.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, commissioners, for allowing me to appear before you again. I was lucky enough to appear before you last week, but the circumstances are much different, and I find this one easier. Last week I appeared in the NSP Solar Portfolio ADP hearing where my basic position was the company didn't need capacity and the energy from that solar portfolio was, the energy was too expensive, very high priced. In this case, it's the opposite. MDU needs both capacity and energy is low priced. And so the staff's position, principled position, remains the same. Towards least cost planning, and in this case, the company has done just that, and so we're supportive of their proposal. I'd also like to just thank Mr. Nigam. I mean, my goodness, he's a great witness. I don't know that there's – I hear many that are better than Mr. Nigam. I will admit that I called him several times to make sure that I had all my facts straight, and so I learned from Darcy just as the commissioner learns from Darcy. I would like also to commend the company for staying with this project because sometimes companies, they run into a little bump in the road and they just quit, and that was not the case here. They worked hard to bring to bring Thunder Spirit Wind Project forward, and so I think they should be commended for that. I would also like to say that, I've done this three times now or a couple of times. I guess the first Otter Tail Power Wind Farm we did by a letter, more or less. But I've been watching the Otter Tail Power Wind Farms. They're significant farms. There's three different farms, and we've noticed in those instances that ownership generally results in a 10% discount to a purchase power agreement. And I know that's trade secret here, and I'm not going to say what the difference is here, but we've noticed that in Otter Tail. And so staff's generally been supportive of ownership agreements over purchase power agreements. We understand that there's a little bit of additional risk you take on when you own a facility versus a purchase power agreement, but we have faith and confidence in the company and its engineers to manage it, and we think that the discount is worth the additional risk. So without further ado, we recommend approval of MDU's request for ADP for ownership of Thunder Spirit Wind Project and its Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity.
Any direct examination, Mr. Shue?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Kuntz, any cross?
We have no questions of Mr. Diller.
Ms. Jeff-Kotsako, none?
We have no questions. Thanks, Mike.
Commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay. Well, someone has to answer your question because you're wearing a suit today.
I would just like to say that since I was at a hearing last week, I knew I couldn't wear the gray one again or the fashion police would be after me. So I had
track.
To reach way back in the closet for the green suit, but I'm ready.
Well, there's a lot of applications that are going to be involving you, so you might need to buy another suit because you're going to be wearing them a lot in the next 6 months.
I'm sure the legislature approved enough.
Oh. A few questions for you, Mike. How comfortable are you in the company's use of market purchases to address both their demand and keeping costs low?
How
what Darcy was talking about at the end of his testimony. Comfortable.
Comfortable. Well, you know, as long as the market remains in a depressed state, and then I think we'll continue to see market energy prices at very low prices, especially out here on the outer edges of MISO, where you can only move so much power out of the state, and we're a generating state. And so I think it's been fantastic for ratepayers to have that kind of exposure to market energy. I commend the company again for doing that. Do they take a little bit of risk doing that? If generally the economy doesn't just turn around overnight. You can see it coming, and there's lots of indicators that you can watch. So I feel very good with where the company is. I like the fact that they use the MISO auction to secure 16 megawatts of capacity at a very cheap cost. You know, if you built that capacity, it would have cost you $1 million for 16 megawatts of capacity for a year, and they bought it for a song and a prayer. And so, what was the other part of the question? Or is that it?
That was it.
Okay.
In terms of wind resources, you've been here throughout the entire development of the wind. Can you just share your observations, maybe how your attitudes towards wind or your analysis of wind has evolved and changed, or and where it is today in terms of its value and its place in the generation resource mix?
Wow.
Philosophize, Mike.
well, I think I was probably like a lot of people when winds first started coming on the scene. It's new, it's different, I don't want anything to do with that green energy kind of attitude. And the philosophical difficulty that I had right away, and I still have, is the fact that the taxpayers are paying for, you know, 40% or better of these projects. We have a federal government that is in trouble financially, and so to give away money and to show preference to an industry, I don't like that. I think the country became great because of free market, free enterprise system, and I think that's going away more and more each year as government agencies, federal, state governments, hand out money and show preference to this party or another party. I think it distorts. We'll call it the total resource plan, if you will. It causes us to do things that we otherwise would not do. So, I mean, it took me a little bit to get over that. Because it didn't feel right. I don't like it. I still don't like it. When I support this project, I realize that both the federal government and the state government has provided incentives to go this direction. So I have to go along with the policymakers of my state and the federal government. When I leave my job at 5 o'clock, I don't like it any more than I did when it first started. I don't like it at all. once you get over the newness, once you get over how it's being subsidized, then it's just a matter of looking at it in pure economic terms. The beautiful thing about low-cost energy like this is that, and it's in my testimony, that even if this company didn't need capacity or energy, there could be a situation where you would build a wind farm anyway if you could get energy cheap enough just to displace the cost of the cost of fuel that would be used to generate your own electricity. And so in economic terms, this is fantastic for ratepayers. We strongly support purchasing this project. We think the extra $30 million of net present value for a PPA is too much.
Okay. And tell me what your view of the commission's role is when we have this on a case like this where you have the rebuttable presumption of prudence. What is our role in this proceeding, knowing that that already is on the table?
Well, I think the rebuttable presumption just shifts the company no longer has to prove its case. The other parties, which is advocacy staff in this case, we would have to overcome that rebuttable presumption. In this case, I'm not opposed. In fact, I support the direction the company is going. So I don't know what else to say to that, I guess.
Okay, that's all my questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman, questions for Mr. Diller.
Thanks, Your Honor. I just want to explore Commissioner Fedorchak's last question a little farther. What's the impact both to the consumers as well as to the company if the ADP were not granted? You've talked about thinking that the project is a good idea. So if CPCN were granted, they can move ahead with it. It's just that the responsibility for bringing it through according to the projected costs and such and making it turn out to be a good project would be on the company. And when that's all proven, presumably, this commission would allow it into the rate structure, if I'm correct. And so tell me your thoughts on that, both from the company's perspective and from the customer's perspective.
Sure. If the commission denies ADP in this proceeding, then my understanding from the application and talking to Darcy is the company would join in a purchase power agreement and pass through those costs through the cost of energy adjustment, which is allowed under current tariffs. And so the short answer is it costs ratepayers $30 million in net present value costs.
Would not getting ADP prevent them from owning it?
It wouldn't prevent them from owning it, but I'm just thinking from a risk perspective. I mean, if the commission denied its ADP, that would be a statement of some kind that this is not prudent, and I assume that would be the basis for denying an ADP, and so I guess the company would have to think long and hard before they would take the risk that later you would say that it was fine and dandy. I guess that would be a better question for the company. I'm not sure. I'm trying to answer your question with my company hat on, and I'm not part of the company. So.
I think you've answered all my other questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu, anything else?
Nothing to add.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle.
Right. No, but I'm not going
to ask. I have no questions unless Jerry wants to take the stand.
Jerry's being ornery, I'll bet.
Jerry and I are discussing the consequences of a denial of advance prudence, but you don't need to.
I will get you back, Jerry.
Mr. Kuntz?
We have no questions.
I guess that's it. You're free to go, Mr. Diller. That was easy. You probably didn't even need a jacket.
Easier than the last one.
Mr. Hsu, anything further from
nothing further
side? Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Nothing at this time, thank you.
Mr. Koontz.
Closing.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner, Commissioners. Just a few brief comments. I don't think there's any question that there's a need for this facility, that it's a good resource. That's why we were, you know, comfortable in entering into a power purchase agreement. And when we initially entered into the power purchase agreement, as Mr. Nygum testified, at $28, that was a cheaper alternative than us owning the facility. For whatever reason, the original developers were optimistic in being able to track financing based upon that particular price. And we were involved meeting with some of their potential financing parties, and all very reputable people, but it became apparent that they weren't willing to take as much risk as what the developers thought they would, and that in order for them to finance this project, the price would have to go up, and there would be some other changes to some of the terms. Well, this was still a good project, even with those particular adjustments. And the company was agreeable to making those adjustments in order to keep the project. And the concern was those production tax credits were going to run out. And if we didn't get our project in place in time for it to be completed by the end of this year, we would lose the opportunity not only for this project, but other projects that, as Darcy indicated, were potentially available to us. And, you know, your next, as our IRP showed, that a wind project of this nature was our least cost alternative. So we kept the company, its feet to the fire in terms of, you know, getting its financing in order so this thing could be completed to qualify for the production tax credits and we weren't left out in the cold with no project. When it became apparent that they were going to have problems doing that, that's when we had turned to Elite Clean Energy. They were a known commodity that had experience. We asked them to take a look at this project. They did take a look at this project, and as Darcy indicated, they were comfortable with it. They didn't see any fatal flaws to it, comfortable enough to give us a firm price to complete it. We didn't want a situation, as Commissioner Christman indicated, we didn't want a situation where we were going to take the risk that, okay, we'll sell it to you for X million dollars, and then before we get done, it's X million plus. They were taking all that risk, and we had a firm price, and they were also willing to give us the PPA price in the event that the ownership option didn't make sense to the commission. So that's really kind of the issue before the commission right now and before the company is we've got the project secured, we've got the resource in place. Now it's a question, should we own it or should we buy this energy under a PPA? And with Mr. Nygum testified, with the modeling we've done at the price under the PPA, we think it's a better deal for the customers and for ourselves that we own this resource. And that's probably not particularly surprising because, as you would expect, Elite, if they're going to continue owning it, all those risks are going to be built into their particular price. If we're willing to take some of those risks, we also have the upside in terms of if it produces more than at the P50 level, there's some advantages there. If it runs for longer than what the term of the PPA is, we've still got access to the resource. We've got access to the expandable piece that Mr. Nygum mentioned. One of the things that we wanted was to be able to control that extra 50 megawatts. We didn't want the developer going to sell that to somebody else. If in the event that 5 or 10 years down the road, wind is still an economic resource and we have a need for it, we control that. So we've got that ability. For all those reasons, the ownership option seemed like the better route to go. So what's the effect of not getting an ADP but still PCNN? I think Mr. Diller hit it on the head. We're basically 6 months on from this project going online in service. If the commission has got a problem with us owning it, we want to know that now, not when it's time to put it into rates. This is a huge investment for our company. We can bring the resources, we can serve the customers with the PPA without any risk on us. But if the commission's got a problem with us owning it, that they don't want this in rate base, then we want to know about it now. And if the commission is saying, we're not comfortable giving you an ADP based upon the facts that you've given us, and less than 6 months out from this going on online, I think our management and our directors and our investors are going to say, why are you taking that risk? There's no reason to take that risk if the commission's not comfortable with it. So we think the ownership option is the better option here. The rebuttal presumption exists, but I think the evidence and the analysis we've done would show that this is the better option regardless of the rebuttable presumption. We'd ask the commission to issue the ADP and the Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity. If the commission grants that, then we'll be in short order here to transfer the siting permit to get that ducks in a row and hopefully get this project online before the end of the year. So we urge your favorable consideration of both applications, and thank you.
Mr. Shue, closing remarks?
Advocacy staff will waive a closing here.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Nothing here, thanks.
Closing comments from the commissioners.
Sure. Well, thank you, everybody. Before I close, I want to mention something that I meant to mention at the start, and that is I want it on the record that Commissioner Kalk is in Washington, D.C. today testifying in front of the Senate Energy Committee, and that's why he's not present at the hearing. It was a last-minute invitation late last week or over the weekend, and wasn't something that could have been switched to avoid this conflict. So we thought it was a good use of his time to go there and speak on behalf of North Dakotans in some of the energy policy discussions occurring in D.C. So that's where he is, and I think he was actually testifying during the last hour or so of this hearing. So with that, I want to just say thank you to the company and to advocacy staff for all the work to clarify the issues, to really be, you know, simple and forthright about what the benefits of this this proposal are. It's I'm very comfortable with it. I think it's really clear, and I appreciate the complexities of a wind generation facility, developing them. There's just so many components to getting all the pieces come together with the landowner easements and all the different towers and equipment. And it's just a complex project. They're complex projects, and so I can understand why sometimes they're not just, you know, simple and done, and they don't evolve exactly how people predict on the front end. That said, this seems like a really good project for ratepayers, and I would look forward to a decision really quickly on this matter.
Commissioner Crisp.
The only closing that I would have, Your Honor, I guess is almost more of a clarification to some of my lines of questioning, and based on some of the responses as well as what we heard in closing, there seems to be a feeling that if the commission were ever to not grant an advanced determination of prudence, that is almost like denying the project into rate base. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I see a point in the evolution of what this commission does and what industry does where the commission could end up managing the companies. If the companies are going to come in for ADP for literally everything, then and not granting it is deemed as a denial, and then they choose not to do the project, eventually this commission will be managing the companies, and I don't think that's appropriate. I don't know where the line is on what projects exactly should be brought to this commission for ADPs. Years ago, I think the discussion around ADPs had to do with large-scale facilities that took years and years to build, and there was a knowledge that during the course of the project, rules and regulations and laws would likely even be changing, and so you couldn't even plan a project and engineer it all out on paper and know exactly what all parts were going to be needed and put in there and know exactly how it was going to come out. It was kind of an evolutionary process, and it was certainly understandable. And in fact, I was kind of an advocate for the ADP process for those things, because it was really the only rational way one could expect utilities to venture into projects like that. Now we're being asked for ADP on projects that are literally months from being ready to go online. And so I don't know where that's all going to end. Are we later going to be asked in years to come for ADP when they want to build purchase a new vehicles for the crew and things like that? I just, that's kind of my concern. So I don't think that the granting of ADP does tell an exact story, but I don't think that ever a denial of ADP should necessarily mean that it's not going to ultimately be approved. And so I guess I would just throw that out, and that's the only closing comments that I have, Your Honor.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Kuntz, anything else you need to put into the record before?
No, Your Honor, I assume we'll go off the record and discuss whether we'll submit proposed findings.
I guess I was going to offer that as a question on the record. Do you intend to provide proposed findings and conclusions in order for both of the filings?
Assuming staff would want us to do that, we can do that.
Staff is asking you to do that.
We will.
Okay. And then anything else that we need to get into the record, Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further.
Mr. Jeffcoat Sacco?
Nothing.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm going to close the hearing on the application of MDU for a certificate of advanced determination and prudence and a certificate of public convenience and necessity. The hearing will be closed at approximately 10:45 a.m. on May 14, 2015. Case number PU 14-843 and 844 are closed. Thank you. Great quality presentation and excellent testimony from